This is Phil Pritchett. Welcome to the P2 Podcast.
There's never been a better time than right now to be a musician.
Giddy hit Austin!
My name's Phil, and I just want to play rock and roll, man.
Tougher than the rest.
The trees shook with sound when the lightning hit the ground with a thud. I was standing on the hillside losing sleep, seeking shelter and leaking blood. Tried to keep my feet moving, but I was soon to find out that running on in the mud. And it was high tide in the heartland, high tide in the heartland, high tide in the heartland, fire in the hills.
Fans, Romans, countrymen, lend me your ears. It's that time of the week, everybody. Hey, it's your old friend Phil Pritchett here on the P2 Podcast, coming to you live every week from Trinidad World Recording Studios, my studio here in Fort Worth, Texas. I am privileged here today to be joined by the great man himself, my good friend, fellow singer-songwriter. He is Kurt South. How you doing, South?
Oh, I am awesome. It's good to be here again.
Well, Kurt has been off the last couple of weeks. We had our old friend Blake Walker in here. You know Walker, of course,
oh,
Kurt.
Oh, absolutely.
Old road manager, fan turned road manager.
What is he to us now?
I don't. You know, he's. You know what he is? He's like a walking encyclopedia of the Phil Pritchett.
Yeah,
Phil
he really is. He's your biographer.
He
I
is.
Think.
Yeah. Maybe he needs
just
to write the book.
Your existence.
When this is all said and done, he can do or make a documentary film, something like that.
Yeah.
I think we got to get a little bigger though. We're well on our way, but we need to reach a point of critical mass to where. You know, when the documentary comes out, some people line up to see it, you know, outside
well,
some little theater.
Well, he needs to wait for you to just combust. Something really tragic happens.
Well, I hope that doesn't. Yeah, right. That's the one sure way for a rock and roll guy to live in infamy, right?
Yeah, yeah. You just have to have your big VH1 Behind the Music moment.
I know it. Well, I hope it's a long way off, God willing. Well, today, of course, we got our three segments we always do here. Our first segment, we always get into some news, some pertinent issues, something that myself or Kurt or any independent songwriter, Texas music guy may be dealing with out there as far as making music, getting it out there. Email us all your thoughts and opinions to phil@philpritchett.com, and we will get to your comments here on the podcast. So at the top, we're going to get into the issue of pricing. You know, it's $1 for a song on iTunes, a CD cost. You know, 10, 15 bucks. What are the pricing issues, man? It's a very, very, very real topic we deal with on a daily basis out there selling music. In our middle segment, we're going to talk about something Kurt and I stumbled upon recently. I think it was when I was watching the Tom Petty documentary where I came to the realization that I love Tom Petty, of course. We all love Dylan. We love George Harrison, the Beatles, Roy Orbison. But you put those men together in the 80s with the Jeff Lynne production, the pink tank tops, all still like smoking a lot. There's a lot of hair, dangling earrings.
A lot of white Reeboks.
You know, acid wash jeans. Why the traveling Wilburys as a group really creep us out?
Yeah.
It's hard for me to admit that. We'll talk about that here in the middle segment. And in the vault, or as we call what's on Phil's iPod, we're going to take a look at the great Van Morrison, someone you can't possibly shed any new lighter perspective on. But we're going to try to by looking at one of his he had his golden era there. I think it was his first five solo records.
Mm-hmm.
We're going to take a look at the somewhat overlooked, I think, It's a small record, only like 7 songs on there, maybe 6 songs. The Great St. Dominic's Preview, something I didn't listen to a whole lot, you know, and you got Moondance playing, you got Tupelo Honey playing, you got Astral Weeks playing. But right in the mix there, I can't remember if it was his third or fourth one, it was kind of right in there. He put this one out, sort of a small, unassuming record, some long, rambling songs on there that we're going to talk about, and some really, really great stuff from Van we're going to look at on Phil's iPod. But back to our discussion here, starting off pricing. You know, Kurt, when I started playing music, you just knew that if you went to buy a tape at Blockbuster or buy the LP, you're spending, $7.99, $8.99, $10, $12. CDs were a little better quality, and you expected to pay, $14, $15, $16, $17 for a CD. The Napster era when it came in, and I guess the real peak of it was right before Napster. I mean, late 90s.
Yeah.
Mid 90s.
When was golden age for the CD?
When was like Jagged Little Pill, Alanis Morissette,
Beauty and the Blowfish,
the first Sheryl Crow album. There was a year in there, it seemed, and I'm just kind of, I don't have the facts in front of me.
Well, that was probably like 93, 94, 95.
Was it that early? I guess that's right.
Yeah, it was. When album sales just really peaked, man. You had bands like Matchbox 20 starting to come out, and Third Eye Blind, where, everyone was just selling.
And that had to be later than 93, wasn't it?
Well, I mean, I was talking about when Hootie and the Blowfish came out, I think, 94.
Yeah. That was Cracked Rear View was 94. Yeah. Is that right?
Jagged Little Pill, I think, it was 93, 94.
Oh, it had to be after that. No?
I was in high school, I think, when Jagged Little Pill came out.
Okay, yeah. Okay.
So you had that golden era of the CD where everybody was going platinum. Going platinum wasn't even a big deal.
Oh, and also that was also the golden era of country music. I mean, that was Garth's reign.
Garth in
full swing.
Alan Jackson was huge.
I mean, those Garth records sold like 10 million copies. I mean, a CD, a hit CD was, those were diamonds. That was diamond.
Yeah.
10's
yeah.
diamond, right?
Yeah.
I don't live in that atmosphere, so.
I've gone ceramic twice.
Have you really?
Yes.
Stainless steel, you got a little stainless steel disc on your wall.
Yes, I did.
We got a lot of stainless steel discs here at Trinidad.
Yeah.
But yeah, you did have the golden era there. But really, of course, the Napster era hits around, 2000, right in there. And all of a sudden, music is free to a degree. That's what started the ball to where we are now. It does make an issue. Kurt and I talked about the new realities of making a record now, or releasing a song, or putting it on your website. Should you just give it away? Should you try to get a dollar for it? Mm-hmm. Should you? What do you think some solutions are? I mean, you put your stuff out kind of here and there,
right.
Smaller records.
Yeah.
What's your initial take on some of this stuff?
Well, I want to start off by saying I don't feel like I have a definitive answer because I'm always struggling with this myself. Mm-hmm. But the way I look at it is music for me or for you to create it, produce it, get it put out is very inexpensive nowadays.
Yeah.
I mean, in the early 90s, it cost tens of thousands of dollars to make an album. My first album cost tens of thousands of dollars to make.
Where'd you get that kind of jack?
Robbed a liquor store.
Subject for another time. We won't get into
yes.
that. Financing the record, always
but,
a nightmare.
But nowadays, I can go record a song for almost nothing.
Mm. Yeah.
And then just my options are, do I just put up on my website and give it away? Or do I try to put it on iTunes and get a dollar a pop for it?
Well, you make a valid point as well that, and we've talked about this before, you brought it up right before we went on the air, that somewhere along the line, the music, the labels, the big labels, started thinking. I remember reading an article with David Byrne, of course, the great Talking Heads frontman, pointing out in an article that, look, record labels don't make music.
Mm-hmm.
Musicians, songwriters make music. All labels make is plastic.
Right.
A vinyl record, a cassette tape, a CD, a plastic little case and some shrink wrap. That's what they produce. Mm-hmm. Without the music, there's no value to this plastic stuff. Right. It's only worth a couple pennies or whatever you pay for it in bulk.
Right.
And that is a valid point. And what has happened, of course, in the digital age is the need for the physical product has eroded. And will just be gone.
Yeah,
save
exactly.
A few diehards who still want a disc and want to read liner notes. And you maybe want to own the odd collectible vinyl record or something like that.
Right,
I mean,
right.
There'll be a niche market for that. But that does kind of beg the question, because the distribution, the warehousing of this plastic material was the real essence of the record business. They were not the music business. They were record business. We make records, and they would pay and facilitate artists to create content
right.
to be on these
products
that then, hey man, we spend a dollar for a plastic disc. You put, Hootie and the Blowfish's 17 songs on it. All of a sudden you sell it for $17.
Right.
That has gone away. And it brings up, we know what it costs to make a plastic CD. Everyone knows a CD costs a dollar or something, you know.
Mm-hmm.
It's hard to sell it now for $15. People know they don't cost that much.
Right.
So take that out of the equation, and what do you have? You have a real vague idea or assessment of what, and the value of that music is worth. I mean,
right,
and you kind of look
right.
at like the Radiohead example, where they gave their new record In Rainbows away, or in a tip jar fashion. Download the record, send us some money if you'd like. And they said, you know, the average was probably around $10, but some people gave a dollar, some people would give $200.
Mm-hmm.
It comes down to what it's worth to that person to pay for it.
And that's such a valid way of approaching it.
Mm-hmm.
Just because to this one guy, your album is worth a dollar, but does that mean he shouldn't own it?
He
still wants it at least enough to give a dollar.
Yeah.
And then there's a guy who'll give you $500 for it because he has the means to do it and he wants to support his favorite act. The truth is on both ends. And like you said, the product was the CD.
That's right.
The music was just the content. And putting a price on that music, that's up to every individual out there, I think. For me, as an artist, it is so easy to go record a song and just give it away.
That's right.
It requires no thought. And that is the marketing. You know, if you put out a CD, a physical product, well, then you're presenting a whole new set of problems or, just a set of challenges of, okay, how do we market this piece of plastic mm-hmm. that stands in between the real value and the content?
Right.
You know,
right.
But with me, I can, I did this when I released that single I did with you, Watertown. Mm-hmm. I just put the MP3 in an email and emailed it to everyone on my email list.
Yeah.
Instantly, several hundred people had that.
Yeah, that's right. That's right.
So
song and was checking it out. That's right.
And people were listening to it. And, you know, I've had people, it seems like every day, South, you need to put a value on your music. Well, I mean, to me, my music is just part of me. It isn't worth something to me monetarily.
Yeah,
it's
right.
just, that's like saying, what is my left lung worth to me? I mean, it's just part of who I am.
That's right.
I who am I to say what it's worth to the guy who comes to my show and is a fan of mine? I might be his fifth favorite artist, or I might be his 200th favorite artist.
Maybe it's got something to do with, you know, the labels when they were at their peak. They dictated what an album, a record was worth because
right.
the demand was so high. When that starts to deteriorate on the far end of the other independent scale, guys like you and me, we're listening to the market. You
right,
know, our
exactly.
five guys who email us all the time or,
yeah.
you know, the people at your show, the people who buy your record, you're listening to them. Would
yes.
they buy a vinyl record? Hell yeah, man. I'd pay $50 for just a double album with tons of stuff in it. And it gives you pause, you know. And,
yeah,
and
it does.
But, man, it is a constant keeping up at this stage. Of course,
yeah,
we've got p2tunes.com. You can download each of our albums for $4. And then we're also on iTunes.
Yeah.
Where it's a dollar a song, more traditional, you know, it's $7 for an album or $8. And we have income from both of those things
right.
very consistently. And, some guy, if he already has iTunes, he already has a couple gift cards and a balance, he'll just get it there.
Right.
P2Tunes, you just get the folder on your desktop, then you kind of you drag it in your iTunes.
Right, right.
So there's another step involved, even though it's cheaper. Yeah, it does bring up something. We'll get in more to. I've had a lot of thoughts, as you know, about. We have the new drop cards, philpritchett.com drop cards, which you get a card. It's like an iTunes card with a code on the back. And you go to a website, type in the code, and you can download everything I've ever recorded, all 11 albums. And we sell those cards for like $35.
Right.
You order it on the website, we mail it to you in an envelope. It's pretty simple. You can buy it at a show rather than buying the CDs. So I think a lot of there's a lot of value there. I do think content. If you do have an iPod that holds 50,000 songs, you're like, hey, you can have all 100 of mine for $35.
Right.
You know, someone might say, man, I like that guy. They're more willing to take a flyer. I'm not saying that quantity is better than quality at all, but
right.
I do think it would help. Quantity does. Would help guys.
Yeah.
And I would look for in the future everyone from the Beatles to Led Zeppelin to Robert Earl Keane, someone with a big catalog, to start packaging their entire catalog in a appealing fashion.
Jonathan Coulton does
price
that.
Wise. Yeah, we talked about Coulton.
You can buy every song he's ever recorded for like $70 or something.
Is that right?
You know, and he has a pretty extensive catalog.
Wow, been around. Yeah, because there is a lot of value in that. I mean, I'll get interested in a band and they've got three other records I've never heard. You know, you're not going to go buy them for $17.
Right.
You don't want to rip the CD in there. But man, if there's just a site that, hey, here's everything for $25, our first five records, you're kind of like, oh, that's a pretty good deal.
Yeah,
you know,
yeah.
I'm going to take a chance with that. Well, that's some pricing talk. Man, there's a lot of ways that conversation could go.
Man, yeah.
We will approach this on many other levels here in future podcasts, to be sure. But coming up here in our next segment, Kurt and I are going to, you know, Kurt's sitting on a couch in the studio. Maybe he ought to lay down on the couch like he's visiting a shrink, you know? Because we're going to try to get to the core of your psyche. And I confess, too, why is it that the combination of such great artists into the Traveling Wilburys, as a collective, we look back on with some disinterest and some unease and are generally creeped out by the whole thing? We're going to try to get to the bottom of that when we come back.
You've noticed, but it seems the life of the party, he never ages very well. And it was that's out in the heartland, that's out in the heartland, that's out in the heartland, fire in the
hell. Welcome back, everybody. Phil Pritchett here, the P2 Podcast from Trinidad World Recording, Fort Worth, Texas. With me is Kurt South, fellow singer-songwriter. Hello, Kurt.
Hello. How are you?
We are going to talk in this middle segment here about and I was hesitant bringing this to the fore here.
it's
a touchy subject, but I've dealt with this now, you know, as a child of the 80s, as a student of the 90s, as a musician in the aughts. I go back a long way with some of my favorite artists. You know who they all are. Well, of course, in the late 80s, you had this dream team of, guys coming together, all of our favorites. You had Petty, you had Dylan, Roy Orbison.
Harrison.
George Harrison.
The best Beatle.
Coming together to make some music, man. And, I'm going to blame some of this on Jeff Lynne, who I do like, don't get me wrong, has made great records and is
a
big talent. But I think he had more influence. Of course, we're talking about the Traveling Wilburys here. And I guess my point is, I'm kind of going around about to make a point. When I see their videos, when I hear their songs come on the radio, when I see footage of them recording, and I the hair on my neck stands up a little bit. And I start to cringe and creep out a little bit, and I can't get a grasp on it.
Mm-hmm.
And it's not that I don't like their music. They made some very nice songs, Oh, wouldn't you say?
Those albums are huge.
I love Tweeter and the Monkey Man.
Yes.
The Dylan is awesome. Yes. I mean, there's some great moments on the records.
I love the records.
But
love
the
them.
Idea of the group, when I see a photograph, when I hear the name, when I see something on TV, I get creeped out and I cringe. Mm-hmm. Kurt, I'm going to lay down on the psychiatrist's couch here.
Get comfortable, and
I need an analyst is what I need.
All right,
because I know I like all these guys individually. How come as a collective group known as the Traveling Wilburys, I'm a little creeped out? Help me, doctor. Doctor, help!
A lot of it was the time that it happened. You're in the late 80s. Everyone is creepy in the late 80s.
Do you have a pillow I can put under my head?
Yeah, here you go.
Thanks,
get comfortable. There you go. You feeling better?
I'm feeling a lot better. Feeling a lot better. I'm on the couch here, folks.
The 80s was a creepy time. Parachute pants and Velcro Reebok high tops. All that
and, of course, these guys weren't young. They're not on. They're not wearing the Vans.
That's the next Pat McGee's hats
or something. They can't pull that off. So what does an old guy from the 60s do in the 80s?
He looks creepy because he's wearing the neon hypercolored tank top or whatever.
Maybe that's got something to do with it.
And he's got the shark's tooth earring dangling down about three inches. You know, and he's wearing some LA Gear sneakers and
top white Reeboks,
just acid wash.
And they have not reached the kind of reform rehab '90s yet.
No,
they're still drinking, whiskey, smoking two packs of cigarettes.
Yeah,
I think that's part of it, man. Because I see them clumped around a console.
Yeah,
and I see Lynn with his sunglasses on. Frizzy poodle hair.
He's the Mrs. Doubtfire of rock and roll.
Yeah,
by
just out there, and you see Petty kind of leaning over his shoulder, and Petty's kind of talking right into his ear, and you know Petty's just
scoring drugs.
He's just smoked a couple cigarettes, had some coffee. Yeah, his breath's got to be late at night or something.
Yeah.
Then Dylan's over there in a pink tank top with some stubble growth. You know, he's got a cigarette in his mouth. He's leaning over Lynn as well. There's all this conversation happening. I'm thinking, man, I start, and then the door swings open. Here comes Harrison,
just wearing a zebra print blazer.
he's in a acid wash denim trench coat, wielding a double neck Ovation acoustic.
Yeah.
He's kind of got the spiked hair and kind of yellow British kind of teeth.
Yeah.
He's always, let's do some more guitar on the album. Yeah. They're all in there smoking, and there's hair everywhere. There's orange clothes, acid wash, high top. Is that where this comes from?
Yeah.
And of course, we love Roy Orbison, but come on. You want to talk about creepy.
Creepy.
Jet black hair, the jet black glasses.
Pale white, pasty skin.
Oh, he looks like a vampire.
Yeah.
He's just in the corner, maybe not saying too much. Roy, how are we going to involve him in the record? And he kind of comes into the soundboard. He's always a little creepy anyway.
He's about to morph into a werewolf or something.
He's trying to put his head in the sweet spot there in the mix. So he's leaning down. So Lynn all of a sudden has like Orbison's kind of a old man, kind of beer gut, kind of pressing into his shoulder blades a little, as he tries to get, and there's cigarette smoke swirling. I just hear, well, it's all right, even when you say all right. And I start to cringe a little bit. I have to skip the station. And I've had nightmares. I've shot up in bed at night wondering, well, how come I cannot come to terms with all these great artists together? So you think it's not so much about the artists or the music of those records as it is just the confluence of the 80s.
Mid to late 40s at the time.
Yeah, they've all kind of probably been divorced. They're not,
they
probably haven't showered. They're wearing tank tops. You do see like underarm hair and stuff, as they're kind of leaning on the console.
At least one of them has on a denim jacket with no shirt on underneath.
Yeah, that's right.
But a bolo tie on around his neck.
Yeah.
I mean,
right.
Just real crazy stuff.
Yeah. And of course, Jeff Lynne, we all love him. Love you, Jeff. He was a big carver of that kind of late 80s sound that you hear on.
Yeah.
There's no doubt, how great Full Moon Fever is. Full Moon Fever, Tom Petty record he made right around that time or a little bit after the Wilburys. But you know, some of those snare sounds and stuff are very, it was very much a product of the day. Although it was his signature sounds.
So yeah, that's, take he, that for he whatever sounded it's like that all his whole career.
Now I feel a lot better. I've been laying on the couch here being my analyst, Kurt. Thanks for helping me here,
hey,
Kurt.
Man, anytime.
How come the Wilburys creeped me out over all these years? I think we found some answers.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, coming up here, we're going to get off the Wilburys and get into some classic stuff, man. Oh, well, last couple of iPods when Walker was here, we revisited some Pritchett records. We talked a lot about Suburban Legends. We talked a lot about Phil Comes Alive. We'll probably revisit those on the iPod occasionally in future podcasts. Email us your thoughts, questions, comments, gripes, and complaints, phil@philpritchett.com. You can buy all of the records, Kurt's and mine, and the Wilburys, at iTunes. Or you can go to p2tunes.com, download my stuff for $4 a piece. Or buy the drop card and get the whole damn catalog for $35. Coming up, we're going to talk about one of my favorite records that I didn't know was going to be my favorite record when I bought it in a used bin a few years ago. I was like, oh yeah, I don't have this one, you know. We're talking about Van Morrison's St. Dominic's Preview when we come back on the P2 Podcast.
Shampoo cleaning all the windows, singing songs about it at PSO. And I hear blue strains of no regret on across the street from Cathedral Notre Dame. Meanwhile, back in San Francisco, trying hard to make this whole thing blend. Yet the city pond is jagged. Story block with you, my friend. And it's a long way to Buffalo. It's a long way to Belfast City, too. And I'm hoping the Joyce won't blow the hoist. Cause this time they bit off more than they can chew. As we gaze out on.
We are back. Phil Pritchett and Kurt South with you today on the P2 Podcast from Trinidad World Recording Weekly. Every week from Trinidad World Recording, Fort Worth, Texas. I'm Phil. With me is Kurt South. Hello, Kurt.
It's an honor and a pleasure.
Well, we're getting to the... I'm sorry, I cut you off there. An honor and privilege. I appreciate it. Oh, man. In the vault today, or the what's on Phil's iPod, still early in these episodes, we don't know what we're going to call everything. If you have an idea, email it to me at phil@philpritchett.com. The final segment where we talk about music we like. Ours... other people's, how it was made, what, why it should be a part of your iPod or your vinyl collection. We're going to take a look at one of Van Morrison's records, early 70s, that I kind of somewhat stumbled upon just as I was kind of, you know, getting into collecting more records. And that is the great St. Dominic's Preview, Van Morrison.
Try to get outside of the shell. Train the crowd and all the chains, badges, flags, and emblems.
Warner Brothers, 1972. Now this was this is his fifth solo record. Of course, Van kind of came onto the scene in various club bands, most notably out of Ireland. Belfast, Ireland came out of there with the band called Them. You ever heard of that stuff? Them.
G-L-O-R-I-A.
Of course, that was a big hit. Gloria. But man, they had a cool... I came across just kind of a collection of Them, the best of Them or something, on vinyl in a stack. And some really cool stuff on there. You know, they do some Ray Charles covers and things like that. But some real rambling, just bluesy... kind of like he'll do on Astral Week. So he does a lot on St. Dominic's Preview.
Yeah.
Where he's just in the zone. He's just almost babbling and just, you know, just the music's droning on. He's just going, wait, I gotta, whoa, you know, just, he just gets into that mode, you know. Some people get really freaked out by it. But I dig it, man. I think he gets so lost in what he's doing. And man, that's what he does here on St. Dominic's Preview. Now, the first in, people talk about Van Morrison's golden era. You had, his first five records, you know, you had Astral Weeks, Moon Dance, Tupelo Honey, St. Dominic's Preview, what was one called? The Street Choir? I don't have that one.
His band in the Street
Choir. His band in the Street Choir. That was after Moon Dance.
Yeah. That's a good album, too. That's,
yeah.
Yeah.
I don't own that one, but Stu had it and told me he really, really dug it.
Yeah.
I had Moon Dance forever, and then I got Tupelo Honey, and then had Astral Weeks on CD. I kind of thought I knew Van Morrison, you know, his early first five records, the golden era of Van. Well, I stumbled across several copies of this record, the blue, you know, him sitting on the church steps there, playing the Martin, you know, and I was intrigued with the cover. I was a little shocked that it does have a grand total of
seven
songs on this record. A couple of which, Listen to the Lion and Almost Independence Day, over 10 minutes long. I think they're 10 minutes long.
Wow.
Long. They end both of the sides, I believe. And Van does get into that zone, man. That kind of Astral Weeks rambling. Of course, you had the great kickoff track, Jackie Wilson Says.
Yeah.
Jackie Wilson said, it was written to you. Kind of love you, but knock me off my feet. Let it all hang out. Oh, let it all hang out. Hey, you know, I'm so wired up. Don't need no coffee in my cup. Let it all hang out. Let it all hang out. Watch this.
That's right. Jackie Wilson said, I'm in heaven when you smile. Just a great, you know, just a flavor of that soul, that Motown stuff that he does so well.
Yeah.
Gypsy then kicks off from there. I Will Be There. Then we get to Listen to the Lion, which is one of my favorite ones. Just a rambling, slow, drawn-out. A lot of those songs like that, I get the impression, Kurt, and I haven't read a lot about how he worked in the studio. You get the impression that he didn't have the lyrics. Or maybe he had an idea. There's a general...
Yeah.
Listen to the Lion, and the band would just play, and he would just kind of hit the mic, turn off the lights in the studio, light a candle, and just fall into whatever was going on. His voice is really more like an instrument. It's not
right.
Word driven. It's just soul driven, spiritually driven.
Well, that's been part of Van Morrison's MO for as long as I've known of him. Is he does use his voice as an extra instrument in the band, a lead instrument like a lead guitar or something like that.
Yeah.
But you know, he's got a lot of the kind of gypsy scat street singer in him.
Yeah.
Combined with the blue eyed soul influence that he does so well. Where he just, you know, music is more about the sound and expressing a feeling using the sound, which in his case is his voice as just another part of the band. And it's a different approach to songwriting and performing than what you and I typically do.
Right.
But you know, I've tried, and I know you've done this recently, I've tried to kind of incorporate some of that, hey, let's not worry about the words, let's just make a joyful noise thing. And
yeah.
And man, it's really cool to do that because you're not thinking about anything other than it's total creation, kind of off the cuff, but... Yeah, Van's kind of cool part of it.
Yeah, and talk about mystique around an artist.
He's
difficult to work with. Yeah, yeah. I mean every producer, we always kind of produced himself.
I believe
at least on these early records, no one could work with him. You know, the label couldn't rein him in and get him to do more kind of single style, Brown Eyed Girl kind of stuff. There was always a lot of fighting with kind of his material. You know, these labels don't like getting 10-minute long songs, even back then. But yeah, man, I mean, just there's he really bangs on the guitar, man. You know, I mean, you hear that acoustic guitar kind of clanging away. And
sounds like it's falling off its stead.
Yeah, just scat singing with his guitar all over this record, especially, like I said, on Listen to the Lion, Almost Independence Day. Almost Independence Day kind of has this, you know, slow drone. I guess it's a synth or something in there. I haven't really detected, or maybe a... just kind of get that...
That's a pre-synth, though, isn't it?
I mean, early 70s, some kind of analog, kind of yes-sounding deal.
Yeah.
So, you know, very bizarre. And he's just I can hear the fireworks. You know, he just lost in his own shit.
Yeah.
Van
he
Morrison.
He impresses himself more than anyone else. Dude, that's what makes him great.
You know, it's funny. People talk about Dylan like this a lot. You know, is it genius? Or a lot of the session guys would come away from a Dylan session or a Van Morrison and just say, man, he just didn't even know what the hell he was doing half the time. Mm-hmm. He had like two songs, and then we just sat there and screwed around on six songs.
Yeah.
And I said, this is garbage. Not garbage, but just kind of like, you know, right. He doesn't care. That's a fine line to draw.
It is, but, you know, to a guy like Dylan or Van Morrison, who's they're an odd sort just from the get-go. If you put them in a room with the song charted out and said it starts here, it ends here, they couldn't do that probably.
Mm-hmm.
Unless it was their idea to begin with. You know, part of their creativity comes from them being such a contrarian.
Yeah,
they're unorthodox. So, you know, that is their creative process, is sitting down in the studio with just maybe a couple chords and an intro.
Letting things develop.
Yeah, because, you know, in some people's opinion, that is real music, is let's get in a room and...
See what happens. Well, like the jazz guys, you know, of course, the Almonds are like that, rock, but, you know, jazz, you have, like, of course, Miles Davis. I mean, any jazz guy, the genius
Coltrane,
of jazz...
Coltrane, yeah.
Coltrane, yeah. Genius of any jazz guy is just evoking the notes, the tone, the melody, all that stuff that's so hard to get your head around unless you play music. You know, how can you just play some arrangement, some song, you know, that's been played a million different times? I mean, because nobody plays it like Miles Davis. No one says it like he does.
Mm-hmm.
And, you know, those jazz guys would go into, you know, you read about Miles Davis and the Bitches Brew sessions and things like that, where it's just an open-ended. He got like three keyboard players and two drummers, and there's a loose structure,
right?
You know, that he's commanding, that he sets
mm-hmm.
at the outset, and the rest of it is just this musical conversation that goes on.
Yeah.
And that's kind of what Van he needs that from his musicians.
Yeah,
you know, when he starts really going, wah, wah, you hear the drums picking up and hitting some big cymbal crashes and flams and big bangs on guitars and organs and pianos and things like that. It's responding to what he's doing and vice versa.
Yeah, he's the catalyst. They're all working off the direction he gives them. If he gets quiet, everybody brings it down.
It's not really unlike having a some directors have a perfectionist type film directors. You have a script, they follow the script, they do every shot, and you say, man, that's what makes him a great artist.
Mm-hmm.
He's a perfectionist. It's precision. You know, people talked about James Cameron. You know, Titanic. Just how he set up every shot, and that's how he works. Spielberg's a lot like that. But then you also have guys who like Woody Allen, guys like that make more of a documentary kind of. Hey, man, all that needs to come out of this conversation is that, you know, you're moving to New York, and you guys, she's not happy about it.
Right.
And there is a script, there is a scene set up, but it part of the genius of it is you kind of let it happen in front of you.
Yeah.
That you don't try to plan out and script every single thing. And it's a whole different way of working, and that's really more like the Van or Miles Davis or something.
Well, the difference is in one scenario, you let the individual players or actors, in whatever the case may be, mm-hmm. express themselves and get to the point the way that they feel like they do it best.
Mm-hmm.
And the other way, you have the real creative force is simply the director or the producer who says, we're going to do it this way, and I'm just using you as a tool to mm-hmm. get to, you know, it's my means to an end.
That's right.
You know, two and both ways work. You know, you can go listen to a very slick, polished, well-produced George Strait single. Mm-hmm. Sounds great. It works. That's what he does.
That's right.
And then you go listen to Van Morrison just go off like he's getting tips on the street corner in Belfast.
Yeah,
beating
right.
on a bongo drum and playing a guitar. But it's all music. It's just a different approach, and it's all great. You
That's
know?
Right.
So
planning as opposed to stream of consciousness kind
yeah.
of writing.
And if you put George Strait in a studio with a bunch of jazz musicians,
tell him to close his eyes and just go with it.
He wouldn't
do very well, would he?
He and his starch wranglers would walk out the door.
But, straight in a vocal booth, just with his cowboy hat on.
Yeah, and they're like, George, close your eyes and really give us some nonverbal communication.
Doing his vocal takes, like while suspended from the ceiling, in a you know, like a Peter Gabriel would do, guys like that. There's a great, you know, after this record, this was, I think it was the fifth one, and this was the last one he did after that great run of five solo records, Van Morrison, 1972. After this record, there was he experienced a lot of stage fright. He went through a time where he couldn't. He got very scared playing. He was playing for a lot bigger crowds than thousands of people now instead of the hundreds he was used to playing for. His career really took off, and he had a hard time. He said he had, and you know, you could argue was never maybe as at least in the studio as great front to back as those first five albums were.
Those first five albums are his definitive. Ubiquitous works. After that, you can take or leave most of what he's done.
There's great moments. And I remember a story an engineer told me in Nashville one time. We were up there recording, and a guy had gotten to work in Peter Gabriel's studio. I'm not sure where it is, but you know,
it's that castle in England.
Yeah, it's in Bath or something outside of London. Yeah. But he's got like this old castle surrounded by a moat. You can go to it's online. There's a great website for it. God's got a name. I can't remember it. I have to look it up. But look up Peter Gabriel Studio. It's like this old castle, and there's a couple different studios in there. And this engineer I was working with in Nashville said, "Man, I got to work at Peter Gabriel's studio." I was like, "Man, that's great, cool." He said, "Yeah, in the middle of the studio, like where the kings would meet, like the food court." He said, "We had every night they would have a really nice dinner in there, a big buffet and some tables, and the different wings of the castle were the different studios. People would kind of congregate in the evening in there and have drinks and eat." And God, just love that image. Wouldn't that be great?
Yeah,
just
that's awesome.
You and Sting and Gabriel kind of hanging out,
much like Trinidad,
chewing on a turkey leg. Yeah, drinking wine from a goblet. Just kind of like, yeah, man, working on the new stuff down the hall here. If you want to come in and sing background and stuff. But he tells the story that he goes in there for dinner one night, and or while he's in the studio, he hears that, hey, man, in the other studio, man, Van Morrison is here. But this is, you know, like early 90s, you know, not too. Van Morrison's here, so man, everybody's kind of on the lookout, hoping to run into him, you know, whatever, on the way to the bathroom or something. So dinner time comes around, and they start filtering into the banquet area, and there's this huge banquet of, you know, food and fruit and bread on this table. Everyone's standing in line with their plates, kind of going through the line, and all of a sudden everybody kind of, oh gee, turn around, here comes Van Morrison. Well, I think in these days, I'm not sure, you know, Van Morrison had put on quite a bit of weight.
Yeah.
Older, you know, glasses, the fedora, and was, you know, up to, God,
he was
well
close
over to 250.
Yeah, I easily. Mean, he was pushing 3.
Big guy. And
he was Stu and Blue put together.
That's right. Surly, surly, difficult Van Morrison. Genius. Here he comes. And everybody's kind of, whoa. And Van just kind of walks right through the middle of the line to the middle of the banquet table, just takes off his glasses and just kind of scans the top of the table, you know, from appetizers over the meat all the way to the dessert, just getting a sense of it. He kind of grunts. He goes to the back of the room and grabs a chair and just drags it real loud across the floor. Just drags his chair. And everyone's like, the line is now backed up and stopped. He just drags his chair over and just puts it down right in the middle of the table, right in the middle of the line, oblivious to anything, and just starts grabbing handfuls of food and just stuffing his face with food. And the line, people, everyone just kind of looking at each other like, what do we? And so people very carefully kind of went around him, you know, out of respect. And he was just sitting there, just with grease all over his face, just gnawing on a turkey leg.
Just putting shrimp cocktail in his hat.
Yeah, just going to town. Like, I mean, he just sat down and just went to town didn't care if he's anybody's way or anything. That kind of, I hope some of y'all heard the Bob Weir story, where he eats the cake. Certainly Van probably suffers from that same star affliction.
He's not used to asking.
Not used to saying like, hey, mind if I cut in line? I'm sorry. You know, he just, I am hungry. Here's the food. This is for me. And he just commences to eat.
Yeah.
And so certainly this is not a condition specific to Bob Weir, but one that Van Morrison, has dealt with as well. Well, that is some Van Morrison talk.
Good talk there. Good
talk about eating. Van eating, Van making great music, and just going off, man.
And please be advised, any of you listening out there who might want to hire Phil and I to come play at a private function, if you have a buffet table, one of us will pull up on either side.
Yes,
just eat
go
with
to
our
town
hands directly off the table, and we look forward to doing that. So please,
I love that moment, man, at a private party where you walk in the room. There's some anticipatory murmuring in the crowd, like, oh, there, you know, here comes the band, you know.
There they are.
There he is, the same guy we saw on YouTube last night. He's now in the room with us. Everyone gets very excited. And then you, then we just make it way over to the buffet.
And just go
to town. Because we know no one's going to say, hey, get in line, jerk, you know. I mean, just, you know. So, although we do stay in line. We're nice guys, and so are you, Kurt. We stand at the back of the line.
Stuffing chicken wings into his beard.
That's right. I'm trying to get to the status to where I just consume things. I just eat things as I walk down the street without any, thought of my fellow man.
I've been doing that since the early 2000s.
I know, that's why you're great. Speaking of great, Kurt does play the hipster hangover party every Sunday at Fred's.
Yes.
7th Street, right?
7th off and 7th. Curry, right 7th off of 7th
Curry.
Street.
Just, the hit part of Fort Worth over there,
Eastern
man.
Eastern University.
Noon every Sunday, you can roll in there and watch Kurt South dazzle audiences for 2 hours, noon to two, and catch up with me, Phil Pritchett, philpritchett.com. Subscribe to this podcast. Download the records. Tell people to listen. It's free. You can subscribe on iTunes. We've got the little logo. We're on iTunes now as far as finding the podcast. Of course, you can always just go to philpritchett.com. And listen to the podcast right off the site. Thanks for being here, Kurt.
Thanks for having me. It's always a pleasure.
For Kurt South, for myself, this is Phil Pritchett signing off on this edition of the podcast. We will join you next week. Be listening, folks, and take care. We'll see you next week. Try to get out.